Well, Thanksgiving is over. Black Friday is over. So is that Purdue IU game. Cyber Monday is tomorrow. We are a mere 4 Sundays of Advent, 2 special services, and 2 weeks of classes and 1 week of finals away from Christmas 2018. The race is on. In the church, we are officially still living in the Middle Ages of time. Back before crass commercialization taught us about giving presents and businesses making, in many cases, all of their profits during the Christmas holidays. I heard yesterday Black Friday sales were estimated to be at $23 billion. Christianity has long acted as if we take the Apostle Paul seriously, who said that we are to be in the world, but not of the world. Now, that's a statement of dualism that I prefer not to participate in, because what often follows such dualistic thinking is that we are merely biding our time in this life so that we can get on to the next one. That heavenly home with streets paved with gold, angel choirs, and the like, where you don't even have to work to find choir members. Such dualism too easily allows people of faith, I think, to take the reality of things like climate change not seriously, when Jesus was never much of a preacher about life to come in the by and by anyway. Many of the early forming Christian churches were about life after death, but Jesus was about life now, being challenged to change into what God has always dreamed for it to be like if God were really in charge. In that prayer that many of us know as the Lord's Prayer, Jesus prays for God's reality to come on earth as it is in heaven. And nowhere in that prayer is there even a small hint that we should be preparing for an eternal home, but rather give us this day our daily bread and teach us to forgive each other's sins as God forgives ours. Nothing about lead us into eternal glory, but rather that we not be led astray into temptations now, but that we would today be delivered from evil and doing evil. And you and I think, are acutely aware, I hope, that as part of a national and global power unit, we are not ever hands clean from systemic and structural evils. I think Jesus went to Jerusalem, where he met his death, asking for the religious structures of his day, the temple, the religious leaders, if you will, to stand with the 99% against the 1%. He wanted merely, I would suggest, for the Jewish religious establishment to relish and lead in the well-established ways of God, rather than be bedfellows with the Roman power brokers and oppressors. I think Jesus went to Jerusalem to try to challenge and then to convert the temple leadership to be faithful to the ways of God. Jesus did not go to Jerusalem to take on the Romans, though I believe that the Roman government felt in danger by the Jesus movement and killed him. Jesus went, I think, to convert an institution that he believed was God's, the temple, back to being a light unto the nation, which I think he felt that it was failing to do. And I think today, God is most intrigued and hopeful, seeking to see us be converted. Us, the so-called good and faithful people of God. I'm nearly haunted by that phrase that God is always about afflicting the comfortable with dis-ease. Uncomfort because we have the resources, we have the ability to be much more radically challenging to relationships and society than we want to actualize. We are the ones that need to be converted. Seriously. We need converted to being the ones that others are praying diligently, hoping for us to show up and save them from their unfairly oppressed lives. Traditional conversion has so many ugly connotations, doesn't it? Churches have long sought to bring people to a so-called saving knowledge or grace of God through Jesus, either by emotional fear of hell or actually fear of bodily harm, rather than by just luring people honestly toward the way of Jesus the Christ. And under the protection of nation-building efforts, traditional religious missionaries have participated in colonization and oppression that would make, I think, the Roman Empire envious, and that would make the historical Jesus weep, as he did at the death of his dear friend Lazarus. We are reminded of the absurd actions of so many so-called Christian missionary efforts this week, as we heard the new story of John Chow, who illegally trespassed on a secluded island in an attempt to evangelize a tribe of indigenous people to bring them to some sort of salvation, and in the process he was killed by the tribe. The man broke the laws of India, who has clearly stated that the island is off limits, private people are protected there from unwanted, uninvited visits. And with unreflective Christian sovereignty and superiority, John Chow violated the sovereignty of these people and endangered their lives on his mission, as these people have never been exposed to germs, among other things, that the rest of the world is just sort of immune to. It was typical traditional evangelism that violates local customs and the bodily safety of the locals, because Christianity has long thought of itself as superior to all other people and their faith systems. And that includes the belief that even if someone dies of disease that we bring along in our missionary efforts, well, that's the cost the indigenous deserve to bear, along with millions of indigenous people who have been enslaved even under the guise of Christ. And even in the midst of this absurdity, International Christian Concern, a nonprofit that aims to draw attention toward Christian suffering throughout the world, wants the indigenous islanders to be charged with murder. Now, I'm giving this as much play in this sermon as I am because in the liturgical calendar, in a vast number of Christian communities, including ours, this is Christ the King Sunday. Is there any title that fits the historical Jesus less than this one? Jesus was a servant to the people, and he fought against all attempts to lead a political rebellion and be crowned king. So what does Christianity do after his death? Oh, they crown him King of Kings, Lord of Lords. And again, I think the Jesus of history weeps, as we should. Here's the thing. I don't think Jesus was ever about power. He was about liberation. But in order to liberate people, rich or poor, he had to many times, I think, subvert the structures. And in order for constructs to work, oftentimes we have to buy into them. To put it another way, in order for the rules of the game to matter, one must typically participate in whatever game those rules are attributed to. And I think there's a lot to learn from this, considering not so much has changed over the years, the millennia, which is why this morning I want to hone in on and highlight, I think, three ways that Jesus was subversive in his teachings and in his life. Number one, he says, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, look at it this way, turn to him the other also. Now, considering that first century culture was just as hierarchical as our 21st century culture, it begs us to question human nature and seemingly our insatiable thirst for power. But although the expressions of power shift a couple thousand years later, a slap to the face is still more insulting than a punch. During the first century, it's said that there were two primary ways to hit a person. One, a punch with a closed right fist. And two, a slap with the back of the hand. And during that time, similar to today, punches were reserved for equals, while slaps were reserved for those who were deemed as lower or less than. And all of this begs the question, why was Jesus so darn specific about which cheek someone struck you on? Because if someone hit you on the right cheek, then they were backhanded slapping you with their right hand, and they were deeming you to be a lesser being. So was Jesus knowingly saying this by turning the other cheek? We're forcing our oppressor to treat us as an equal? Matthew Lutz and others have highlighted that the slap on the right cheek is not what would ordinarily happen, since one either must be left-handed or hit with the back of the hand. Number two, and if anyone would sue you, take off your tunic and let him have your cloak as well. As many of you have seen, you've seen paintings of Jesus, and you generally wore back then two garments, a tunic and a cloak. So when Jesus says, if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well, he's oddly telling us to get naked in public. And he's saying this because during that time, being naked wasn't as shameful as one viewing your nakedness. Shame, Jesus knew, similar to today, is a very powerful tool. It's an emotion that people, most of us, will avoid at all cost. Forcing someone to be naked and then seeing them nude would allow room for thought. It would subversively force their hand to then hopefully reconsider whether or not the cost of shame is worth this minute, minute, temporal feeling of empowerment. And then number three in today's scripture lesson, and if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Most of you know this story. It's a subtle nod to first century Roman law. At that time, before there was cars or trains, a soldier could order any one of us to carry his pack, but there was a limit. You could only carry it for 1 mile. And although there was donkeys and there were mules to carry their equipment, possibly conjecture here, but it's possible that being ordered to by law to carry a soldier's pack was a form of degradation. So when Jesus says, and if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles, you'd have the playing fields evening out when the soldier is then begging you to give his belongings back in order that he does not break the law of 1 mile. It's a paradigm shift, and Jesus was always about that. You notice here that Jesus was never encouraging violence. In fact, he exhorts his followers to not resist. And he knew people spending their lives chasing after wind instead of just sitting back and enjoying the breeze. He knew that there are people who don't feel joy from winning or from seeing other people win. They found joy from seeing other people lose. And we fast forward through the red letters, zooming in while not losing sight of the bigger picture. We see Jesus saying a few chapters later, for John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man, speaking of Jesus himself, came eating and drinking, and they say, here's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is proved right by her deeds, end quote. Be wise and understand that there is no joy found in vengeance. I hate that. There is no life found in violence. And maybe this is why he also said that the thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy, but I have come to give you life. Maybe he wasn't being so literal when saying to the zealots that if you live by the sword, then you'll die by the sword. What we all love so much about Jesus is that he wasn't trying to lord himself over anyone. He could have, I guess, but he chose not to. When Jesus ended up before Pilate, before Herod, before Caiaphas, Christ was simply not participating in playing their games. Do we want power? Or do we want to experience being part of the kingdom of God? Believe in evangelism, but not in the kind that so many have and still do participate in? If our faith has merit, I'll take you out of it. If my faith has merit, if my faith has true meaning, then my life should demonstrate it in real ways. And those that our lives are impacting, I think, should have little or no idea that our actions occur because of what we believe, because what we say and what we do need to be seamless. Jesus never demanded faith of others. Jesus desires others to know our faith by who we are and what we do. Christianity, I don't think, is superior to other faith systems. It's one of many very excellent faith systems that seek to liberate those lost in life and to enhance the lives of those who are oppressed. Any faith system that enhances our global community of people and other creatures and that does as little harm as possible has my vote as a good faith system. I was trying to think where I started this sermon. It's kind of hard to remember, isn't it? Oh, yeah. Well, the race is on towards Christmas. It's not about a king being born, but a Palestinian Jewish boy being brought into the world and out of near absolute poverty and political oppression that makes, incidentally, our President Trump look like a schoolboy. From that boy born, and he was, a great light has shined into our world, and as a result of that light, we know better how to live than ever before. The light has shone and is simply, I think, waiting, in my estimation, to be so lit in you that others will say, you got to come and see this person. Something special is happening in them that makes me want to live in a similar way. It's the best Christmas present, I think, that we can give to our world is how we allow the light of God to shine out of us. The race is on, but you have plenty of time to light your light.